From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump urged his Turkish counterpart Wednesday to limit the country's incursion into northwest Syria to avoid U.S. forces operating in the region, while Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on the U.S. to halt shipments of arms to YPG Kurdish rebels that it's fighting. Speaking Wednesday to local officials in Ankara, Mr. Erdogan denounced the YPG and Kurdistan Workers' Party for having blood of tens of thousands of people on their hands. He suggested the incursion, which began Saturday, may expand to the Manbij region, a Kurdish-held area east of Afrin province, where the U.S. has helped the Kurds defeat Islamic State. University of San Francisco regional analyst Stephen Zuna said the YPG has been a reliable ally to Washington.
The U.S. support was quite important in their defeat of ISIS, liberating these towns from ISIS control. At the same time, their movement is very much of an independent one. It's been part of a struggle that's been going on for decades. And so the Kurds will continue being an armed group, a militia that will be fighting for autonomy and for the rights of the Kurdish minority.
An estimated 2,000 U.S. troops are in Syria. The Turkish offensive launched Saturday aims to neutralize the YPG that it sees as a security threat linked to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party. Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, Wednesday said the country will hold transparent elections by July, and he will respect the outcome even if the opposition wins. The election will be a test of his legitimacy since taking power in November after the military intervened to oust longtime ruler Robert Mugabe. This is VOA News. Former U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson resigned Wednesday from an international board that advises Myanmar, also known as Burma, on the Rohingya crisis. He said it was conducting a whitewash of the government crackdown the U.N. has described as ethnic cleansing. Richardson said State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi lacked moral leadership and has been ill-advised.
I think this is caused by the bubble that is around her, by individuals that are not giving her frank advice.
The former U.N. ambassador and New Mexico governor resigned as the advisory board was visiting Western Rakhine State, where nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled a military crackdown. The U.S. Wednesday said four Americans were among the 22 people killed when the Taliban stormed the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, Afghanistan, late Saturday. Two other Americans were wounded. Meanwhile, the charity Save the Children is suspending operations in the country after Islamic State militants attacked the agency's office in the eastern city Jalalabad, killing at least four and wounding nearly 30 in a shootout with police that lasted hours. Three Save the Children staff members were among those killed. The top U.N. official for Somalia Wednesday said that while al-Shabaab remains a serious threat, the terror group is on the decline and the continued deployment of African Union troops in Somalia is essential to its ultimate defeat. U.N. envoy Michael Keating told the council members that al-Shabaab remains a potent threat despite, or perhaps precisely because, it's on the back foot as a result of financial pressures, counterterrorism operations, and airstrikes.
Defeating al-Shabaab, Mr. President, requires both a military and a political strategy, the use of both sticks and carrots, as well as sustained efforts to address deficits that lend extremists a degree of credibility. These include corruption, lack of education and job opportunities for young people, weak national justice and corrections capacity, and grievances arising from unresolved disputes.
Keating also warned the council the country is grappling with a severe humanitarian crisis. Persistent drought and conflict have left millions in need of assistance. The death toll from Tuesday's twin car bombings at a mosque in Libya's eastern city Benghazi has risen to 35, one of the highest from a single attack since the North African country slid into turmoil following the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The U.N. Security Council Wednesday gave the parties to a peace deal in Mali until the end of March to show progress or face sanctions for obstructing a 2015 peace agreement. The council adopted a French-drafted statement expressing impatience regarding delays in making the agreement a reality on the ground. British pop musician Elton John Wednesday said he's quitting the concert tour once he's planned the one for September ends. In an interview, John said the children in his life have changed his priorities. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Burundian opposition leader says no to 2020 election taxation.
You are just given less than $100, and one is asking you to pay all the taxes you pay regularly, and then from that money you have to give an extra contribution. Where do they want people go?
Agathon Rwasa is also the Deputy Speaker of the Burundian Parliament. Ugandan President Museveni says he likes how U.S. President Donald Trump speaks frankly. The Nigerian government responds to criticism from former President Obasanjo. And a new report says inconsistent laws and sexual taboos put the health of adolescent girls at risk in Zimbabwe.
Our report highlights four key barriers to sexual reproductive health services in Zimbabwe. One of the critical ones is inconsistencies around the age at which young girls can go to the clinics for health services and information.
Louis Kamodi is an Amnesty International researcher. A rights official sees progress in the Gambia 1 year after Yahya Jammeh, but that more needs to be done. And activists in Sierra Leone seek protection for sex trade workers. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi opposition leaders have rejected the government demand for citizens to contribute to funding the 2020 general presidential elections. As Moses Habyarimana reports, they are accusing the government of forcing citizens to contribute to funding the elections.
Since last year, Burundi government initiated a mechanism to collect funds for the 2020 general elections. It will be the first time the country fully funds the elections after the key donors of European Union and the United States suspended direct aid to the Burundi government, citing the human rights violations in the country since 2015 when protests against the incumbent president's move to run for a third term in the office erupted. Agathon Rwasa is the opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the parliament. He says that the contribution is contrary to the country's constitution.
How come that we are asked to pay our monthly wages and beyond this to make another contribution as institution? So it is a kind of racket which is being done by the state.
Mr. Rwasa is among the opposition members who refused to the wage cut in the contribution to the 2020 general elections. He says that citizens are already contributing through taxes.
Come and see what kind of life people are living now. You are just earning even less than $100. And one is asking you to pay all the taxes you pay regularly. And then from that money, you have to give an extra contribution, yet the price for oil and food and everything is increasing. Where do they want people go?
Burundi Assistant Home Affairs Minister Terence Nahiraja says that no citizen is forced to pay the contributions, but rather a gesture of patriotism. He says that the project is ongoing very well, though some citizens are against the contributions. He says that citizens have different opinions and no one can be forced to contribute, and that there are also those who are against the elections and democracy. But everyone in Burundi is free to say what he or she wants. Citizens stayed away to comment on the election contribution. Some are against the contributions and others support it. Every family or household is expected to pay 2,000 Burundian francs, that is equivalent to more than $1 per year. Students of the voting age are also expected to send in their annual contribution of almost $1. The 2020 general elections contributions are expected to run for a period of 2 years that kicked off early this year. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Amnesty International says inconsistent laws and sexual taboos put the health of adolescent girls at risk in Zimbabwe. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the claims are made in a new report being released today, Thursday.
Ahead of the launch of the report called Lost Without Knowledge, Barriers to Sexual and Reproductive Health Information in Zimbabwe, Amnesty International researcher Lois Camord told VOA that she hoped her organization's findings in the report would push President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to amend the country's laws to ensure adolescent girls are less vulnerable to unwanted pregnancies and risk of HIV infection.
Amnesty is making a number of recommendations. Our report highlights four key barriers to sexual and reproductive health services in Zimbabwe. One of the critical ones is inconsistencies around the age at which young girls can go to the clinics for health services and information. So girls were telling us that they, at 17, even if they were pregnant, they were being turned away. They felt that they were too young to go to clinics for help. Girls at 15 who were already having sexual relationships, not being able to go for services because of their age. We're really calling on the government to clarify that adolescents have the right to these services and to put their laws and policies that at the moment are inconsistent and contradict each other, to make them very, very clear so that all adolescents can go for these services, regardless of whether they have their parental consent and regardless of their age.
The Minister of Social Welfare told VOA that she was aware of the problems adolescents in Zimbabwe were facing. She said Harare was working on a new law to ensure that adolescents enjoy the right to reproductive health just like any other citizen in Zimbabwe. She said her government was aware of the Amnesty International report's findings, which documents how widespread confusion around the legal age of consent for sex, marriage, and accessing health services is leaving adolescent girls more vulnerable to unwanted pregnancies and at higher risk of HIV infection in Zimbabwe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
U.S. President Donald Trump's recent alleged comments about Africa may have angered many African leaders, but not Uganda's Yoweri Museveni, who says he loves Trump's blunt honesty and thinks the United States has a great president. Halima Atumani has more from the Ugandan capital.
President Yoweri Museveni got legislators from the East African community laughing when he said he loved U.S. President Donald Trump. Earlier this month, President Trump allegedly called Haiti and some countries in Africa an expletive while discussing the subject of immigrants going to the United States. While some African countries, such as Nigeria and South Africa, reacted by summoning U.S. ambassadors to explain the insulting comment, Uganda's Museveni instead had praise for Trump.
America has got one of the best presidents ever. Mr. Trump, I love Trump. I love Trump because he tells Africans frankly. I don't know whether he's misquoted or whatever, but when he speaks, I like him because he speaks frankly. The Africans need to solve their problems. They need to be strong. In the world, you cannot survive if you are weak.
Museveni is not the only Trump fan in Uganda. Local radio presenter James Onen, who is known for his controversial comments, says many Africans believe their countries are the word Trump used because many of the best and brightest flee the continent for better opportunities. He thinks, however, that Museveni's comment was ironic. After all, he says, if African countries are bad places to live, is not that the fault of those in charge?
So it's almost an admission of his own failings. But secondly, I think President Museveni also is being strategic. He understands that by being in the good books of Trump, it might mean better things for him and less problems for him down the road.
Uganda's representative to the East African Legislative Assembly, Susan Nakauchi, agreed with Museveni's comments, but says the challenge with Africa is that it does not have opportunities such as Western countries.
We should not leave outsiders to come and try to provide solutions to us. Because when you give them that opportunity, they come with their stringent conditions. So all these people would come to us with all these favors and whatnot. They expect something in return, maybe in terms of investment. So I entirely agree. Africa is full of very smart people, only that we don't have sometimes the opportunities that our people in the first world do have.
Museveni may have praised Trump for his comment, but Uganda's Speaker of Parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, did not let the comment slide. While meeting the U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Deborah Malak, on Tuesday, she asked what Trump meant by his uncomplimentary remarks. Ambassador Malak described the comments as disturbing and upsetting. Halima Athmani for VOA News.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 25th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Prominent Egyptian human rights lawyer Khaled Ali, the last main challenger of incumbent Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Egypt's presidential race, announced Wednesday he has dropped out. The announcement came a day after Egypt's military detained former Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Sami Anna, the only other serious challenger to Sisi in the presidential race. Candidates had reported media attacks against them and intimidation of their supporters in an election they say is stacked in favor of Sisi. A spokesman says Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is bent on fulfilling the mandate he was given when he was elected in 2015 and is not worried about his re-election in 2019. This comes after former President Olusegun Obasanjo criticized the government, saying President Buhari should not seek re-election in 2019 because his government has failed Nigerians. Mr. Obasanjo said he will promote the formation of a political party called the Coalition for Nigeria to challenge President Buhari should the president decide to seek re-election. But Information Minister Lai Mohammed says Nigeria under President Buhari has improved in many categories, including a $40 billion rise in foreign reserves, falling rate of inflation, and a decimated terrorist group Boko Haram on the run.
Our position really is that the issue of whether Mr. President should run or not, I think, is destruction. And we are not really ready to dwell on that. So we have a mandate, and we are bent on delivering on this mandate. And as I try to express in my statement, even President Obasanjo scored us very high on two of our commitments, which is fighting corruption and fighting security. He was not quite impressed about efforts to revamp the economy. And we also tried, even on that score, to really let him realize where we were coming from and where we got him. And that even on the issue of the economy, we have done extremely well. We have been able to exit recession, not that alone. Every economic index is positive. We have, for 11 months, continuously reduced inflation. We have created 6 million extra jobs in agriculture alone. So we believe that within 2.5 years, what we've achieved is phenomenal.
Now, first of all, let me ask you, does President Buhari intend to seek re-election in 2019? Because the former President Obasanjo is suggesting here, promoting the idea of forming a political party, an opposition political party, to contest the election. He calling it the Coalition for Nigeria. Does the President Buhari, will he seek re-election? And does he feel, or does the ruling party here feel threatened by what the former president is saying?
James, like I told you, we have a mandate for Nigerians to run the affairs of this country for the next 6-17 months. And that is our priority. We will not be distracted with the issue of second term or not, but rather we will focus on what we have at hand and we want Nigerians to judge us and what we have achieved.
One Achilles heel for this government is this idea of fuel. Nigerians have been complaining about the fact that a country that produces oil is not able to take care of this constant fuel problem.
You see, we are not a government that passes the buck. And as such, we recognize the challenge, recognize the hardship Nigerians are facing, and we are spending every little moment to address these issues and resolve them.
Where is the government now? The war on corruption, is it succeeding?
Even our critics admit that, yes, the war on corruption is succeeding. We succeeded in driving corruption under the table.
Boko Haram, the president had promised shortly before he was inaugurated that he will wipe away Boko Haram. What is the progress?
James, if you remember, when we are in the office on 29th of May, 2015, Boko Haram was active in almost 10 states of the Federation. Boko Haram at Wilstock, in Kano, in Sokoto, in Niger State, in Kaduna State, in Plateau State. Today, we've succeeded in severely decimating this insurgency, and we've confined them to a small corner of Borno State. And by any record, this is an achievement.
Nigeria's Information Minister Layo Mohammed was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. This month, Gambia celebrated the one-year anniversary of former dictator Yahya Jammeh's departure. During the past year, the country moved toward improving the economy and human rights. Amnesty International West Africa researcher Sabrina Matani talks to Ricky Shryak about the progress that has been made and what remains to be done.
Well, there's a lot of progress that's been made in Gambia. I mean, in just a year being in Banjul, you notice such a difference. People are free to speak. There's lots of radio stations, discussions going on. Yeah, a huge kind of feeling of freedom. And there's lots of law reforms that have been initiated. The government has committed to having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a constitutional review process, reviewing repressive media laws. So there's a lot, you know, that's changed that's positive. In terms of victims, I mean, there has been a commission that was set up to investigate, you know, missing people, and the Truth and Reconciliation will take this. There's also National Intelligence Agency officers, which is still ongoing. So I think, you know, a lot has happened. But for many people in Gambia, they do want justice and they do want, you know, Jammeh to be tried. But a lot of them actually just care about the day-to-day things. They care about, you know, having food on the table. They care about the police being reformed so that they're not asked for money. So I think it's also that kind of broader long-term human rights reform and economic reform that people care about.
Have there been more day-to-day reforms than in terms of corruption, bribery, things like that?
Well, the government is beginning this process. So they've been trying to like strengthen institutions. There's a lot of training that's gone on for security officers. A lot of proposals for law reform, but a lot still needs to happen, particularly with security forces. There was a whole operation in the National Intelligence Agency. It's mostly that institution that we as Amnesty documented committing a lot of the torture and forced disappearance. And that institution really needs a lot of reform. There needs to be like an independent police complaints commission set up, a vetting of those who committed serious human rights abuses are still not taking position. So a lot still needs to be done in that area.
A couple of weeks ago, there was an incident while the political parties were gathered. I believe a kind of a fight broke out between different party members. After that, Gambia suspended permissions for rallies and other public political events. Has that ban been lifted?
Yeah, I think that the clashes between Jammeh supporters and coalition supporters shows that, you know, Gambia still really needs to heal, that there's a lot of tension ongoing. And it's really our hope that the government and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission can prioritize sort of national healing and unity. And also there's a lot of ethnic division between different tribes. And so there's a lot of work that still needs to go on. It's really important for us that the Public Order Act is reviewed and is made less restrictive, and that there is a lot more space for peaceful assemblies. And we haven't really seen that so much in this new Gambia. There was an Occupy Westfield protest a couple of months ago, and that was broken up by riot police. Given the context of the new government, and that so many violations of peaceful assembly were kind of critical to the government coming to power, it's really our hope that they'll actually prioritize reforming that and allowing Gambians to, peacefully assemble.
That was Sabrina Matani, Amnesty International's West Africa researcher. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. In Sierra Leone, as elsewhere, commercial sex work is still stigmatized. Sex workers say they face assault and routine intimidation by police, clients, and others. Local activists are working to provide greater opportunity and protection for women in the sex trade. Nina DeVries has the story for VOA from Freetown.
Mariatu Sese runs a small roadside cafe on the outskirts of Freetown, but it's more than just a place to get a cold drink or a warm meal. Sese spends much of her time training any sex trade worker who wants to learn how to cook and run a small business. Sese says she has helped about 47 women get out of the sex industry.
I have a passion for this job. Since I was around 7 years old, I used to see plenty of women doing sex work. They used to come in our compound, they wash there, they used to keep their things there at times. Their beach boys used to beat them for money.
Sese has her own story too. During Sierra Leone's 11-year civil war, rebels killed Sese's parents and captured her. She was 11 years old and forced to become a sex slave. The war ended in 2002 and she was eventually able to go back to school. Others haven't been so lucky. Many girls became orphans struggling to survive on the streets after the Civil War. And that is one reason the sex trade is prevalent in Sierra Leone. It's estimated there could be up to 300,000 female commercial sex workers in Sierra Leone, according to 2013 figures for the National HIV/AIDS Secretariat. However, it's believed that number has increased due to the Ebola epidemic, which ended in 2016. Julie Sese, no relation to Mariatu Sese, is a program manager for Advocade, a legal aid group that helps vulnerable women.
The increase is due to the fact that many families lost parents. And after the loss of both or single parents, there is very high likelihood that there will be increase in poverty. And if there is increase in poverty, no education, then what do you expect a young girl to do? Is to plunge themselves into sex work.
The laws in Sierra Leone are ambiguous on prostitution. Selling sex is not illegal in and of itself. Julie Sese says female sex workers are arrested for offenses such as loitering, and they have been arrested for working in a public place. Advocate says the women are rarely convicted on these charges, and the state is wasting resources. One sex worker in Freetown who asked VOA not to share her name due to stigma described her recent arrest. The woman says she lived with an aunt who was abusing her, so she ran away and began selling sex. She was eventually arrested for loitering. She says the police beat her, and when she had no money for bail, they asked her for sex instead. She refused and spent a month in jail before Advocate intervened and got her released. Advocate says this is a common scenario, one the group also highlighted in a recent documentary. Police told VOA they are investigating the allegations. Ibrahim Samora is a public relations officer for the Sierra Leone Police.
It is our duty, you know, to look into those allegations. It's our duty to engage our personnel. It's our duty to sensitize them and to tell them that stringent disciplinary measures will be taken. Whereas if any police officer is found wanting of any of the allegations raised.
Meanwhile, at the roadside cafe, Mariatu Sese stocks up on star beer for evening clients with one of her trainees, Mary Aruna, a former sex worker.
She learned me to make.
Speaking in her native Creole, Aruna says she has learned to save money better and believe in herself again. As for Mariatu Sese, she says she will remain an ally for sex workers and continue to empower them. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The top UN official for Somalia said Wednesday that while Al-Shabaab remains a serious threat, the terror group is on the decline, and the continued deployment of African Union troops in Somalia is essential to its ultimate defeat. UN envoy Michael Keating told Security Council members that defeating the group requires both a military and political strategy and a serious effort to address issues that terrorists exploit, such as corruption and the lack of jobs and education opportunities for youth. The United Nations has warned Wednesday that 1.5 million South Sudanese are on the brink of famine and that 20,000 are already in famine conditions. UN Humanitarian Chief Ursula Muller told Security Council members that more than 5 million South Sudanese, nearly half of the country's 12 million population, are believed to be severely food insecure. The UN has asked for $1.7 billion for 2018 to meet rising humanitarian needs in South Sudan. And that's it for this Thursday, January 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the death of 38-year-old Ugandan refugee Alfred Olungo, who was shot and killed by police in California in September 2016. His death was among several captured on video in a year when anger over U.S. police shootings, particularly of black men, rose to new heights. Olungo's status as a Ugandan refugee brought international attention not only to the issue of race, but how police react to people who may have psychiatric problems. VOA and our partner station NBS TV in Kampala teamed up to examine what happened and whether the shooting could have been prevented. The death of Alfred Olungo on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.